Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 5th day of February, 2022. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and where do we begin to look back on a week like this one? Lots and lots of lies, lots of them coming apart. That hardly even sounds like news anymore. So let's start off with what I'm going to call the tyranny exposed update. And this seemed like a good representative lie on both of those fronts. From Jack Phillips in the Epoch Times, the U.S. Federal Death Agency, FDA, has issued a warning. Oh, we better take that seriously. About two COVID-19 tests made by a company called Empowered Diagnostics. That ought to tell you all you need to know. Why are they warning about these tests? Well, because they aren't FDA approved, even though the tests have labels saying that they are. Ooh, good grief, give me a break, and who cares? Look at the COVID-19 Zyklon B injection. That bogus approval doesn't actually require testing, and for crying out loud, they're injecting it into service people without bothering with the approval. From there, let's go to another three or maybe four-letter tyrannical agency that wouldn't exist if we still actually had a constitution, especially a Bill of Rights. The ATF has admitted that they are keeping a secret database, to hell with that Second Amendment thing, of nearly 1 billion gun records. And please try to tell me you didn't know this all along. This comes from the Gun Owners of America, courtesy of the Machine Gun Nest, and it starts out like this. Hey, what always precedes gun confiscation, as even a cursory look at history will make clear? Gun registration, of course. It worked great for Adolf. Enforcing universal background checks, because you slaves can't own anything unless we say so. And ensuring, yeah, the same people that want you dead want to make sure you're safe, you bet. In reality, what a registry guarantees, says TMGN, is that large-scale confiscation is a lead pipe cinch at some point. Which is why, back when we had a Second Amendment that says shall not be infringed, the unconstitutional ATF wouldn't have existed, but once it did, it was still forbidden from explicitly keeping such a searchable database by what now passes, yeah, for law, for all the difference that makes. And as I mentioned, GOA announced that the ATF has nearly 1 billion records of firearms purchases, with over 850 million of those now digitized. They contain all sorts of personal information that wasn't supposed to be kept on what they still call gun owners, but remember, they don't think of it that way. You slaves aren't really allowed to own anything. And in addition to what tools they have purchased, other information, including names, addresses, place of birth, and often social security numbers, can be found on the records as well. And it all comes from that slave permission slip known as the ATF Form 4473. Deep down in the story, this is kind of funny. How does ATF justify not only their existence, but their massive invasion of privacy in doing something that they're explicitly forbidden to do? They claim that, quote, the vast majority of criminal firearms traces are done for state and local law enforcement agencies pertaining to active investigations. But in true federal government style, they also mention they have no idea just how effective, if at all, this system is, and whether any of this information could ever lead to successful prosecution of gun crimes, except, obviously, on propaganda TV shows. All of this is interesting, says the story, and here's the real point. Given that the Biden regime and their Department of Just Us want to change the regulation so that these records can never be destroyed, even though they shouldn't have been taken in the first place. And they're making incremental steps every day towards reaching that goal. And let me say this, folks, as an engineer and somebody who's been around a while, once these records exist in digital form, and that goes for just about anything in digital form, the one thing you can guarantee is that you'll never, ever be able to prove that it was ever really destroyed and that there's not a copy hiding somewhere. And if it's Big Brother, especially if it was forbidden by law to begin with anyway, you can pretty well guarantee that. Keep in mind that with the recent push to regulate everything from bits of plastic to semi-auto firearms as machine guns, that registry is a darn handy tool for those that want to gang rape the Constitution and confiscate what's left of America's liberty teeth. And as more and more people are figuring out just exactly what evil plans Big Brother has for them and their children and their children's children, that's getting more urgent by the day as well. from Joseph M. Hanneman via the Epoch Times, as well as Zero Hedge and others, Kelly Meigs and other members of the Oath Keepers couldn't have done any of the major things of which they're accused by the federal liars at the Department of Justice, and that's forcing their way into the U.S. Capitol Rotunda back during the infamous January 6th false flag through the famous Columbus doors, says defense attorney Jonathan Mosley. Those two sets of historic doors that led into the rotunda were therefore opened by someone on the inside and not his client. Department of Justice video that eventually slipped out and was widely circulated on Twitter since last week shows a man trying to open the inner doors by leaning against them before turning around as if he was listening to someone, then returning to the entrance and opening the left door for protesters. Okay, better put, for the scapegoats. Quote, the outer doors are cast from solid bronze and would require a bazooka, an artillery shell, or C4 military-grade explosives to breach, said Mosley in a letter to federal prosecutors. That, of course, did not happen. You could sooner break into a bank vault than break the bronze outer Columbus doors. The 20,000-pound doors that lead into the rotunda on the east side of the U.S. Capitol are secured by magnetic locks that can only be opened from the inside using a security code controlled by say it with me, folks. Capitol Police, he wrote in the 8-page memo. Imagine how the prosecution intends to prove at trial what can't be proven because it's not true, he wrote to prosecutors of the Attorney's Office for the U.S. District of Criminals. Who's going to testify that the defendants entered the Columbus doors when the U.S. Capitol Police will begrudgingly testify that it's simply not possible and cannot be done? The bogus indictment charges that Meigs led what they call a stack formation up the Capitol steps to that entrance at the Columbus doors, and at 2:39 p.m., the doors were breached, and stacked one entered with the mob, according to the indictment. There's a big problem with the accusation, though, says the defense attorney. It's impossible to force entry from the outside, because only someone with the security code could have released the locks, and only from the inside. Therefore, QED, nobody opened those rotunda doors from the outside. Anybody else suddenly thinking of the famous Sherlock Holmes quote from Arthur Conan Doyle? How often have I said to you, he wrote, that when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And guess what? After all of that, Mosley accused the prosecutors of crafting what he rightfully called a fabricated case against the Oath Keepers that's, quote, false and reprehensible, saying it's not about an attack on our republic. The prosecution is the attack on the republic. They're seeking to criminalize political dissent, free speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of political association, and the right to petition government for a redress of grievances. This baseless prosecution, he wrote, is the greatest threat to the republic since 1812. Here's another one of those tyranny revealed stories that basically boils down to tell me something I don't know. Lockdown measure, says a piece from Ivan Penchikov via the Epoch Times, used by Big Brother governments worldwide to allegedly reduce the death toll from the pandemic, had, as it turns out, little or no impact on COVID-19 mortality. According to three researchers who screened almost 18,600 studies to select the 24 papers used for the final analysis. The study specifically looked at mandated government measures, including the idiotic mask mandates, as well as travel bans, rather than voluntary measures. And they concluded that the lockdowns in Europe and the United States had, quote, little to no public health effects, but they have imposed enormous economic and social costs where they have been adopted. In consequence, they concluded, lockdown policies are ill-founded and should be rejected as a pandemic policy instrument. And while the tyrannical measures may have had little or no impact on actual COVID-19 mortality, the lockdowns did have a significant effect on people suffering from other ailments, including those that were lockdown-induced, including self-destructive things like suicide, alcoholism, and drug abuse. But lockdowns also, they note, led to some 40% of American adults delaying or avoiding getting urgent medical care in June of 2020. And in the UK, lockdown-related delays to lung cancer diagnosis alone could have led to an extra 2,500 deaths. This, according to an analysis by the UK Lung Cancer Coalition, and of course, the same thing applies to any number of other potentially life-threatening ailments. Here's another one, and it's certainly the kind of thing that ought to get a lot more attention than it's going to, especially when it comes to the waste stream liars. A speech therapist says that mandated mask wearing during the pandemic has caused a 364% increase in patient referrals of babies and toddlers. Jacqueline Thieke told WPBF News that before the pandemic, only 5% of patients were babies and toddlers, but that has now soared to 20%, and parents are describing their children's speech problems as COVID delayed. Well, how about Big Brother delayed, with face coverings being the primary cause of their speaking skills being seriously impaired. As young as 8 months of age, babies start learning how to speak by reading lips, a thankless task if parents and caregivers are forced to smother themselves with masks in order to comply with the idiotic mandates. So the therapist, it's very important to kids to see your face so they can learn, so they're watching your mouth. What the hell have we done? End this cruel insanity. Since the pandemic, said Thieke, autism symptoms are also skyrocketing. Quote, they're not making any word attempts and not communicating at all with their family, she said. Furthermore, and this is absolutely satanic, folks, a study by researchers at Brown University found that mean IQ scores of young children born during the pandemic have tumbled, literally been hammered, by as much as 22 points, while verbal, motor, and cognitive performance have all suffered as a direct result of the idiotic, death-dealing lockdowns. Again, Michael Kurza noted two of the primary causes are face masks and children being atomized as a result of being kept away from other children. The inability to socialize at parks with the children of their parents' friends or to study facial expressions on the faces behind the masks in indoor or public spaces have significantly reduced verbal, motor, and overall cognitive performance compared to children born before, said the new U.S. study. Tests on early learning, verbal development, and nonverbal development all produced results that were far behind those from the years preceding the tyrannical lockdowns, wrote Curzon. And I guess only time will tell at this point, folks, whether Big Brother has now succeeded in producing a generation of sociopaths that have been deprived of vital early emotional and interpersonal development opportunities. And on that score, I think it really is interesting and even encouraging that there are a number of honest liberals who are waking up to what the authoritarian, outright totalitarian far left is attempting to do, and in fact has been getting away with. This comes from Naomi Wolf, a famous leftist who's among those that can see where this is headed. On her own Substack, she writes about what she calls On the Subtlety of Monsters. My first post, she wrote in this three-part series about how the evil that surrounds us has manifested, was about the elite global technocrat class and their distance from the people whose lives they may crush. I noted, too, their lack of belief in or loyalty to the nation state. And add to this toxic myth, she said, is the certainty of this class of people that they know best about your life. Doesn't that just basically describe the totalitarian left and, indeed, all of those who know better than you what you need? Including whether you need to live or die. I made that case, she said in that essay, that surrounding us now was a metaphysical, seemingly, and I think she gets it right here, a satanic level of evil. And I'm seeking to explain in this series of essays how otherwise nice people, and indeed Western people who grew up with post-Enlightenment norms about human rights and the rule of law, can be doing evil now with whole hearts. I have a suspicion, folks, the one thing that she's missing here is an understanding of, well, what were once called self-evident truths, that there is a God, that he made us, and that our rights come from him. But let's give her her due. I'm asking, she says, how can they be suppressing the respiration of children intentionally? How can they be consigning friends and colleagues to eat in the street like outcasts, or sending cops to arrest a woman and terrify a 9-year-old child whose only crime was that they tried to visit the Museum of Natural History in New York without their papers? How could nice people in the humane West put on the agenda for the state of Washington just 2 weeks ago that those who are exposed to a contagious disease be placed in forcible quarantine without charge, without trial, and dependent on a court order and good behavior just to be allowed out? All of this, she writes, is happening now in America. She spelled it wrong. It needs a K, of course, but she seems to be coming to that understanding. The land of people who, since she says the Civil Rights Act of 1964, have had the principle of equality governing human relations as a matter of law. Well, at least that was the theory. A nation that's passed laws against the abuse of or corporal punishment of children in public cesspools in the 1970s in virtually every state, and people who've been raised in a culture of freedom and civility compared at least with lawless or outright totalitarian regimes that led them for the most part to be, on the scale of decency to cruelty, at least up until 2 years ago, very decent people. Yeah, how could good people be going along with this? Well, there are two lessons from history we'd better learn or relearn, and quickly. And yes, she says, even though some leaders and commentators, that includes her and it certainly includes your host, have passionately and publicly been comparing those years, 20 through 22 in America and Australia, to the early years of the Nazi regime, and though she says we face criticism for doing so, I won't be silenced about this because these similarities must urgently be addressed. People had better reread their Nazi history if they've ever read it at all, she says. They're getting it wrong when they demand, how dare you make the comparison? Because while the popular imagination of the Nazi era may be associated with death camps, and people think of them when the word Nazi is invoked, the fact is that many years led up to that horror. Germany invaded Poland in 1939, and the extermination camps were established years into the Nazi drama, 1941. The more apt comparison has to do with the vivid similarities between our moment in the West since 2020 and the COVID era, and the earlier years of Nazi Germany's civil society policies back in the early 1930s, when so many vicious norms and policies were set in place. But these were often culturally or professionally policed rather than being policed by camp patrols. And that's the point that better informed analysts of these similarities, says Naomi Wolf, are trying to make. Now, as your host has suggested, for at least a decade or so now, we're a bit further down the line than she has yet figured out, but hey, at least she's moving in the right direction and beginning to realize the things that have been long set in place are bearing their wicked fruit. Even the honest left seems to take a bit longer to wake up to where their policies inevitably and historically lead, but again, she's getting there. Writes Naomi Wolf, during those years, mass societal cruelty and a two-tiered society itself that perpetuated this cruelty was built up and policed, just like today, by polite civil society institutions tasked with snarling and baring their teeth. Casual escalating cruelty, a culture of degradation of the othered, and a two-tier society were built up in those years at the behest of Nazi socialist policy. But the construction of a world of evil out of what had been a modern civil society, even if a fragile one, was also endorsed and even policed by doctors, by medical associations, by journalists, by famous composers and filmmakers, by universities, by neighbors, teachers, and shopkeepers for years before the eventual death camp guards were tasked with their own far more heinous cruelty. Here she turns to Amos Ehlon's poignant history entitled The Pity of It All, A History of Jews in Germany, 1743 through 1933, which reveals just how many Jewish civil society leaders warned about the imperceptible shifts day by day in the direction of evil. In 1931, street violence was directed against Jewish storefronts and led to smashed-in windows. In other contexts, Jews were beaten upon leaving synagogues. Commentator Theodore Wolf warned, this simply cannot continue. All decent people, irrespective of party, must form a common front. And so, says Naomi Wolf, might one say today. But, she notes, decent people did not do so then, and Wolf's call to action was of no avail. Ehlon calls these years the last spasms of freedom. And Wolf's publisher told him to tone down his warnings in the interest of advertising and circulation, all the way back then. And just as today, those issuing alarms were suppressed and censored. And now, folks, it's being done at even a higher tech level, and arguably more ruthlessly. And just as today, emergency laws were the benchmarks that would allow society and the form of government, she gets it wrong, no, it's not democracy, but it was at least at one point supposed to be a republic. Whatever it was, though, it collapsed. Hitler, writes Ehlon, wanted full powers like Mussolini's in Italy, and he knew exactly what was needed to turn a government into a legal dictatorship, emergency powers, under Article 48. See if you notice any echoes here, says Naomi Wolf, because currently 47 U.S. states are operating under emergency measures which suspend or bypass normal legislative checks and balances, including, well, Tyranny Central, New York, the state from which she says she's writing. Under emergency measures, pretty much anything can and is being done. And the fact that most people still don't seem to understand that most of the country is living under those emergency measures is what's stunning about our current moment. That's why I keep saying these days that the coup d'etat has already taken place in America, and she's absolutely correct on that score. By definition, when you live under emergency measures, you no longer have a functioning democracy, or even, folks, a constitutional republic. Let me summarize, she says, where we are right now in America, as well as in the West, just in case you've gotten too used to it, too conditioned to see it clearly. She warned in the End of America, a letter of warning to a young patriot, that democracies, or even republics, do not usually die with a cinematic sense of goose-stepping brown shirts suddenly in the streets. They tend to die rather, just like Elon described, incrementally, day by day, collapsing grotesquely in some areas of society, and in regards to some institutions, even as other aspects of society and other institutions look and feel, well, at least superficially, just the same as they did before. And just because these settings may be familiar to us now doesn't mean that a 1931-like reality, if not yet a 1933-like reality, isn't upon us, or folks, for that matter, a 1939-type reality. In this country, she says, citizens are being forced to take their second or third or pretty soon fourth experimental gene therapy injection in order to be allowed to go back to school or keep their jobs as truckers crossing borders or as soldiers or sailors or military pilots or hospital workers. And millions of others have not escaped this coercive experiment, especially in parts of Europe. Minors are being forced to submit to the experimental gene therapy in order to keep playing high school basketball, baseball, or tennis, and thousands of adverse events are being recorded in VAERS, including deaths shortly after vaccination. But the forcing of injections continues, despite the fact that it's now obvious that they have no effect on transmission, and it's against all existing laws. Voices of opposition to tyrannical overreach, she writes, are being censored en masse. Payment processors, she writes, are declining to process funds of entities offering medical therapeutics. Well, folks, they've been declining those that believe in the Second Amendment for years, and most recently, some of them have tried to steal funds from things like truckers groups, the Freedom Truckers, protesting tyrannical overreach in Canada. Also in Canada, some grocers have been told that it's optional to allow members of, you know, that group to buy food. Children in Canada are being told no mask, no voice. Those set apart as other, falsely called infectious, and positioned as unclean. And your host is suggesting, yeah, they are in fact the new N-words, may not enter buildings or restaurants in New York, Washington, District of Criminals, or San Francisco and L.A. on the left coast. Everyone's being asked to hate and resent them and irrationally blame them for the nation's predicament. People are being asked, in other words, to join a cult and offer up their bodies. If they don't, they're ostracized and denied social life and professional advancement. First, it was effective treatments that might have discouraged the eventual poison poke, like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, that were ruthlessly deep-sixed. Now, a class of therapeutics called monoclonal antibodies have just been withdrawn by the Federal Death Agency so that ill people won't have that choice available either. What do you call all of this, she says, if it's not an early Nazi-like set of practices? And at this point, she references Robert Proctor's magisterial 1990 book, Racial Hygiene, Medicine Under the Nazis, which points out that it was doctors who were then tasked by that state and given special status and authority while singling out, quote, life unworthy of life, and elaborating racially based policies that separated the clean and the privileged from the unclean, the degenerate, nowadays we would say deplorables, right, and the restricted. In 1933, doctors began to sterilize the unfit. And gee, folks, your host can't help but think that's happening now, but most people won't realize it for years. And here she quotes three doctors who wrote the Nazi Physicians as Leaders in Eugenics and Euthanasia, Lessons for Today, to say that, quote, a series of recurrent themes arose in Nazi medicine as physicians undertook the mission of cleansing the state, the devaluation and dehumanization of segments of the community, medicalization of social and political problems, training of physicians to identify with the political goals of the government, fear of consequences of refusing to cooperate with civil authority. Gee, folks, doesn't this sound like something right out of official Biden regime policies? Bureaucratization of the medical role and the lack of concern for medical ethics and human rights. Half of Germany's physicians, the story notes, joined the Nazi Party. Proctor even addresses the health pass that was established by the Nazi public health policy, a pass that separated those who could fully participate in Nazi society from those who were singled out for deprivation and disgust. They even say it with a sneer, the unvaxxed. Which sounds a lot like today's characterization of similar people as useless eaters or unfit who don't deserve food and are a burden on public resources and shouldn't be a drag on hospitals or receive medical care, much less organ transplants. Proctor, she says, shows what a short slide it was from public health officials identifying, quote, life unworthy of life, these useless eaters, to the same officials now using the language of hygiene and public safety to set up the first Nazi euthanasia programs, programs targeting those who were identified as less than or in some way impaired. And then, as now, whether the term is public health or racial hygiene, they use other terms too, like safety and harm reduction. Those propaganda-like terms concealed then and now conceal the true nature of what should be a visible, nauseating, and daily spreading evil. The monsters, she says correctly, are walking among us, and we better begin to immediately and forcefully call them out. We'll have more right after the bottom of the hour break. Stay with us. Welcome back now to the second segment of the show for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Call, and the theme of the week does seem to have been lies revealed, whether Big Brother likes it or not, and they do just keep on coming. But first, let's start off on at least a bit lighter note, not only with some good news, but with some stuff that, yeah, it's funny as all get out, and you really can't believe it, but we're used to that. Let's call this intro Leftist Puppet Tricks. And again, we'll start with the good news. Breaking, says the coverage from Christina Layla at the Gateway Pundit, Jeff Zucker, the infamous leftist censor and coordinator of liars at CNN, has resigned his position. CNN's worldwide president, Jeff Zucker, yes, resigned on Wednesday and said the network his resignation was effective immediately. Why? Mr. Zucker's relationship with, get this, an actual female and an adult too, Allison Gullis, CNN's chief marketing officer, was revealed during an investigation into other sexual misconduct at CNN, like disgusting reprobate Chris Cuomo, brother of the mass murderer from New York. And although both Zucker and Allison Gullis are divorced, says the piece, Zucker didn't disclose their relationship. That's the problem, because it was required. And by now you're probably wondering, what's the good news in all of this, Mark, besides that Zucker is gone? Answer, well, it's good news on multiple fronts. One, another far leftist has gotten caught. But here's the surprising, amazing, almost unbelievable part. He actually reacted with integrity. Who could have thought it? Rules apply even to Jeff Zucker. And he's resigned. Would that that could start a trend. On the next to communist puppet tricks, item number two. And I made the conscious decision, folks, not to talk about this story when it came out over the weekend. After all, how much hypocrisy can we stand in just 1.5 hour? But now there's an update, and yeah, this one's choice. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti was spotted in a photo at a suite during the 49ers-Rams game at the SoFi Stadium in Los Angeles on Sunday, along with California's communist dictator, too, and the mayor of a once beautiful city, now a disgusting cesspool, San Francisco. There's a trio for you. They were posing with Magic Johnson, and horror of horrors, who can imagine such a transgression? None of them were wearing their mandated face diapers. Now, as any regular listener knows, I could care less. It's pure idiocy anyway, and obviously harmful to the wearer, so why not? Well, the reason is because these are the lying scumbags that mandated it and said, oh, you peons must follow the rules. So yeah, they're hypocrites, but wait a minute, tell me something I didn't know. They even posted the photos online, I guess making the point, rules are for you peons, not us. When Gruesome Newsom was caught, he claimed he only took the mask off for just a brief moment to take that photo. However, video footage later Monday showed that, yeah, he's a liar, the truth is not in him, and nobody, not even the leftist press, is actually surprised. But lying scumbag Eric Garcetti literally took the art of in-your-face whoppers into low Earth orbit when he channeled Bill Clinton in what the Gateway Pundit calls the updated version of I didn't inhale. Confronted with his shameless rule-breaking and in-your-face hypocrisy, the Los Angeles mayor, speaking to a crowd in Englewood on Tuesday, claimed that he had held his breath when he took those maskless photos with people at SoFi Stadium. I know, how stupid is he, and just how stupid does he think all those people listening to him were? So let's hear it from his own lips.
When people ask for a photograph, I hold my breath and I put it here and people could see that.
No, actually, Eric, what we can see here is something far more important and, yeah, absolutely revealing. I wonder how many people are paying attention, though. From there, on to the really heavier news, and we'll introduce it with an observation that whenever people really do start to stand up against tyranny, especially if it's extremely effective, like the Canadian Trucker Freedom Convoy has been, you know darn well that the fascist tyrants who feel threatened are going to not only double down, but strike back. First via their control of money, then with violence. The UK Daily Mail headline seems to hint directly at both of those, although, true to form, they ignore the historic significance of it. The headline says, GoFundMe. Remember them? That fascist organization? That's more than happy to raise funds for you and release money if you're far left. But if not, nah, they may just steal it. GoFundMe, it says, freezes the Canadian Freedom Convoy page after they raise, not just $5 million at this point, $8 million. And they say it this way, and liberal Ottawa politicians are calling for those funds to be stolen, seized by Big Brother Maple Leaf as the crowdfunding site faces questions on why it flip-flopped earlier and their decision to release at least a tiny bit of the money. Maybe they were threatened with a lawsuit for theft. Did they ever think of that? Subsequent events seem to suggest it certainly wasn't a crisis of conscience. Meanwhile, though, the chief of police in that nation's disgusting excuse for a capital, Ottawa, suggested on Wednesday that the Canadian Armed Forces might have to be called in to handle the lingering protesters in the capital. You know, those fringe people that don't have any right to speak out against what's being done to them. Why? Well, because Ottawa's force of 1,500 so-called officers just simply aren't capable of blocking access to the capital. And he said at least 50,000 officers might be required to handle the tiny fringe group. Doesn't that reveal the lie, too? So military options remain on the table. Meanwhile, the protesters have said they have no intention of leaving until the government actually recognizes what was once called freedom and scraps the absolutely reprehensible vaccine mandates. Police, though, those that might have to execute a few folks, have declined to end the protest, citing the risk of aggravating tensions. And here's at least a bit of good news. In Alberta, some 2,000 miles west of Ottawa, police attempted to force truckers blocking that border to move. They even tried to call in tow trucks to help haul them out of the way, but the tow truckers sided with the truckers. They weren't willing to come and oust their fellow Canadians. So the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had to retreat. Continues the story, this is the second time that the fascist GoFundMe organization, and by that, folks, I mean a public-private partnership. Yeah, they're private when it suits them, but they're public when it comes to doing whatever Big Brother wants them to. First, back on January 25th, GoFundMe claimed when only about $5 million had been raised, they needed to freeze the money so that they, Achtung, could determine where the funds would go. And then in response to public pressure, they were caught. They released $1 million in a couple of days, and the campaign was allowed to collect more money. Makes you wonder what they had planned at that point. Said a company spokeslawyer at the time, but now the company's facing even more questions, this time from their Big Brother public-private partners about that quick reversal. And get this, how's this for a whopper compounding a whopper? Whether or not their move was politically driven. Huh? You might think they have it backwards, but remember, you're a fringe element who's not allowed to speak, so far as Premier Trudeau is concerned, and Liberal officials now claim that the government should have control over all of those millions. Und people steal them if necessary, said Ottawa City Councillor Diane Deans, channeling Adolf. We need to cut off the pipeline of funding to these people, mercenaries, if you will, that are unlawfully protesting. Who does they think they are? And occupying our communities. It turns out, folks, that even GoFundMe admits so far over 120,000 separate donations have been made to those who are seeking to strike back at the fascist government in Ottawa and try to regain at least a bit of what were once called Canadian freedoms. Meanwhile, the Daily Mail notes that the Freedom Convoy that's paralyzed the Canadian capital entered its sixth day on Thursday. And here's a related story, good news and bad news. The good news is that the success of the protest in Canada has spurred other people to take similar actions worldwide, and trucker convoys are springing up in a number of countries, including the once-free United States, where American truckers, says a piece from StrangeSounds.org, are following Canada's lead and organizing their own protest against the unconstitutional anti-human vaccine mandates. The U.S. group's Facebook page, however, and this is why I call it Two Facebook, was removed early Wednesday in a move that the organizer called censorship at its finest. said organizer Jeremy Johnson, who helped set up the two Facebook group. His personal account was also removed, prompting him to contact a civil rights attorney to discuss the next steps. Quote, they like to silence people who speak the truth, he said, speaking the truth and also the obvious. And the rest of the article goes through the he said, she said, how two Facebook basically says, they contacted you, and you are violating our policies. And the organizers say, no, they didn't, and besides, they never tell us, and hey, who are you going to believe here anyway, folks? Big Brother's public-private partners? Those that are pulling the strings and violating the entire concept of free speech, or those that can't talk back anyway? Now, there is one more interesting bit of, I guess I got to call it good news here. To Facebook and its stock, or as Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden put it, it's now called Meta since it's in the Witness Protection Program, is making record after dismal record Thursday morning after its catastrophic earnings and guidance Wednesday night. Not only is the company's 22% overnight drop the biggest in its history, but according to Bloomberg, that one-day crash ranks among the worst in stock market history, and To Facebook has erased some almost $200 billion, call it $195 if you care to be more precise, of its market capitalization, making it the biggest collapse in market value for any U.S. company ever. And who deserves it more? Well, okay, I certainly don't want to forget Pfizer, Moderna, Apple, Microsoft, Gulag, Monsanto, and who knows how many other wannabe mass murders, but at least it's a step in the right direction. Oh, yeah, and Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden seem to think it's important to put this in context. The 20% decline in Meta would be more than the equivalent market value of some 452 of the entire S&P 500 member companies. And since Meta is weighted at 2% of the S&P 500, that decline alone contributed to a 0.44% negative impact on the S&P 500, and the sheer size of the two Facebook collapse here illustrates just how tech companies have ballooned in size to become behemoths with unprecedented market power and the drama that can ensue when they ever so rightfully stumble. Analyst Bill Blaine in his Morning Porridge puts it this way, Meta's collapse on the back of competition, regulation, and maturity, question mark, might just be the moment that the whole new thing bubble popped. Oh yeah, and while we're on the subject of the arguably well-deserved collapse in Meta, aka Two Facebook, this story may or may not have something to do with it. Comes from USA Today. It got picked up fairly widely, and the headline has to do with virtual rape and what's called the metaverse. A woman in the UK, it says, wrote a blog post on Medium about how she experienced a real horror play out in the virtual game called Horizon Worlds, developed by Meta, formerly known as Facebook. Within 60 seconds of joining, she wrote in the post, I was verbally and sexually harassed by 3 to 4 male avatars with male voices. Essentially, though, they virtually gang-raped my avatar. And then she went on to detail watching her avatar get sexually assaulted by a handful of male avatars who took photos and sent her comments like, don't pretend you didn't love it. The problem is, the woman turns out to be the vice president of Metaverse Research for Kabuni Ventures, an immersive technology company. And in case you've not heard about it, Meta envisions a virtual world where digital avatars connect through work, travel, or entertainment using VR headsets. Zuckerberg has been famously bullish on the metaverse, believing it might even replace the internet as we know it. And some are now suggesting, maybe you don't want your 18-year-olds being allowed in there alone. And I guess just to bring that point home, after she wrote about it, the woman, whose name is Nina Jane Patel, recounted that she received comments calling what she wrote a, quote, pathetic cry for attention, while others urged her, hey, now you know better, don't pick a female avatar next time. Now, as for your host, folks, I can't help but think, gee, maybe there are a whole lot of different morals in this story. Oh, and one more bit of good news from the Canadian Freedom Convoy front before we move on to some really nasty news. TGP and 100% Fed Up are reporting that the Truckers for Freedom convoy in Canada have now been joined by farmers and, yeah, we talked about this, kind of, sort of, tow truck drivers who have broken through the police blockades in a show of support for the truckers' anti-vaccine mandate movement. After that trucker convoy succeeded in blocking the U.S.-Canadian border between Alberta and Montana as part of their protest, the police set up barricades on the highway. They called in those tow trucks to try to come and remove these semis from blocking the highway. And yeah, as we pointed out, when the tow truck drivers did show up, instead of coming to tow the semis, they joined the protest instead. But that's not all. In addition to tow truck drivers, farmers have now also come to join the protest, breaking through the police barricades with farm equipment in order to join the hashtag Truckers for Freedom movement. And there are videos online.
Your power's a weak old man.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
As we're seeing, folks, the real Darth Vader and the dark side is far more evil than most people can possibly imagine, but continues to reveal itself. Here's a case in point. Hospitals in Germany, the UK, and Israel have all refused life-saving transplants to one of the new N-words. Yeah, in this case, a 3-year-old child, because his parents were unvaccinated, so he doesn't deserve to live. Writes Zero Hedge, covering the summary, we've heard of cases where adult patients in the U.S. have been denied life-saving transplants like heart or liver because they haven't been vaccinated. But have you ever heard of a child being refused because their parents hadn't been poison-poked? Well, now we have. Politico in the EU reports that a 3-year-old Cypriot boy was denied a heart transplant by, first, a hospital in Germany, allegedly because his parents hadn't taken the full set of Zyklon B injections. No, they weren't, quote, fully vaccinated. And it turns out it wasn't just Germany. The boy was then turned away by hospitals in the UK and Israel for the exact same reason. Finally, a Greek hospital was found to do the transplant, but the story is going viral anyway because it's the latest example of COVID tyranny run amok. And while all of this is bad enough, folks, I can't help but think of another interesting anti-parallel here. Can you imagine the worldwide headlines if this boy's parents had been HIV positive and thus a lot more politically correct? Yeah, a real disease that might actually kill the parents, and I'm sure worldwide media would have had a hissy fit if the hospitals had dared to turn a pair of homosexual male so-called parents away, even if they were actually positive for a politically correct disease. And there's one more interesting and, yeah, disgusting sidelight in this story. After the Cypriot Health Ministry first made arrangements for their boy to be treated in Germany, they were still left scrambling after that so-called hospital advised that they wouldn't accept the patients because his parents hadn't been fully vaccinated. So they caved. Both of them took the first of the poison pokes, but after they got that first dose, in an effort to sacrifice their life for their child's, they were informed it didn't matter anyway, because it would still take 6 weeks for them to become fully vaccinated, if they survived that long. So the father, noting that he'd heard that unvaccinated patients were still sometimes admitted to hospitals in Germany, I didn't know I had to be vaccinated for my child to be operated on in that hospital. If I knew, of course, I would have done it. I'm healthy and did not want to be vaccinated. I find it inappropriate for someone who is healthy to be vaccinated. Well, folks, obviously we've gone far, far beyond inappropriate. Speaking of inappropriate, more and more Americans are realizing that a senile alleged president, who's really a communist Chinese puppet anyway, is, at least a bit inappropriate. But when it comes to polling, says a piece from the Gateway Pundit, Joe Biden has moved beyond the unconstitutional, the tyrannical, the senile, and the inappropriate into truly dangerous territory for even a faux president. Not only does he have the worst polling numbers for any president since polls were taken, more than half of voters, says a new Rasmussen poll, believe that senile Joe Biden is, quote, one of the worst presidents ever. And what? Only one of? Oh, yeah, and guess what, folks? As one wag pointed out, he's not going to improve with age, either. As your host has pointed out many times by now, though, those who are pulling Biden's strings really do want you dead, and there's no longer any real denying it. On Monday, I closed the show with a story from a farming insider who warned that the coming food shortages are going to be far worse than we're being told. Quoting a farming insider who wishes to remain anonymous, he said, things in 2022 are interesting and scary because input costs for things like fertilizer, liquid nitrogen, and seeds are likely triple or quadruple the old prices, and it simply won't be profitable to plant this year. Let me repeat, said the farmer, the economics will not work. He goes on to talk about a number of farmers converting from planting corn, even if it's GMO, to soybeans because they require less fertilizer, which, folks, is arguably even worse. And yeah, even if you don't want to eat that GMO stuff, remember the ripple effects. We're going to see them real big time before too long. And right after that story came out, there was this about an uncontrolled fire at a North Carolina Winston-Salem fertilizer plant, which started Monday night but continues to burn through Thursday morning. The plant produces ammonium nitrate and had more than 500 tons of the potentially explosive chemicals in storage, so firefighters have been reluctant to go in and do much. They originally evacuated some 6,500 people from within a mile of the area. They're still saying there's a major risk of explosion, but it hadn't happened yet, and firefighters still can't get within 300 feet of the volatile blaze, and they're not sure when they might be able to get any closer. Said Battalion Chief Patrick Grubbs, "We're not sure. It could be another day or another week of waiting. We don't know." As of Thursday, the area's had rain, which is helping a bit, and officials from multiple agencies are still saying they don't know what could have possibly caused the fire. But those who are watching the farm system supply chain breakdown and are concerned about a famine are certainly suspicious. Given that there's already a major fertilizer shortage worldwide at this point because of fossil fuel issues, the timing of this one certainly seems coincidental, if not outright, well, more than that. And referencing the recent astounding rise in worldwide fertilizer prices, Michael Snyder of the Economic Collapse blog has an update where he spoke to a geology insider this time who explains why the global energy crisis, and along with it, arguably, a famine, is going to get much, much worse. "I'm a geologist," he explained, "who's worked in the oil industry for over 10 years and was just coming out of school in time for the shale revolution. He worked in Denver on the Bakken play in North Dakota, then on the Permian out of Midland. And there are two major oil shale plays," he says, "so I know firsthand about both of them. Anyway, back in 2015, I was starting to see reports coming out from analysts that the shale industry would run out of new places to drill shale oil wells in the Permian as of 2021. These reports weren't telling me anything new, just giving me a likely date. You see," he says, "shale drilling is drilling in poor rock quality. Prior to shale, we didn't have to frack wells because the rock quality was great. But we've drilled all of that good rock up, so we're now really scraping the bottom of the barrel. And way back then, there was a recognition it wouldn't last forever. Oil is a limited resource. For a time, it was barely economic to drill shale wells because the margins of drilling in such poor rock were slightly better than what you could make on interest due to quantitative easing policy. Most of the shale oil companies, though, were simply Ponzi schemes, and the shale industry lost billions as a whole. We've talked about that on this show, folks, for a long time now. When you do stupid things economically, you do stupid projects because they wouldn't otherwise be economically feasible. Well, anyway, as a result of this loss of capital, there was record production. And needless to say, Wall Street figured out eventually that they were not making money. So the industry was eventually capital starved. That's one problem. The other is that there just aren't really any more drilling locations. All the good ones have been drilled up, which is why you don't see a rush of shale companies returning to drilling, even though oil prices are now rising fast. And that lack of investment, as well as the economic disincentives that Big Brother is pushing against anything fossil fuel related, adds your host here, will continue to push oil prices higher. So we're at a place, he continues, where much of America's oil production now comes from shale wells. But the problem with shale wells is that oil production declines much faster than wells drilled in what we now call conventional rock. And although conventional oil production has been on the decline for a long time now, shale helped to make up the production. The problem is, as the drilling rate of those new wells slows, the decline in oil production will be much steeper. And there are problems in oil production worldwide, too. Venezuela, now a basket case, was once a major oil exporter. So were Colombia and Mexico. Saudi Arabia won't be far behind because they've been lying for years about just how much oil they really have left. And as Snyder himself has pointed out, when you add wars and natural disasters to all of this, we really are in big trouble. And when you factor in that much of the deep state, the globalist welfare state, and the international trade system that we have, based on funny money, was all built on the back of cheap oil, it's pretty clear we won't be seeing that again. Some people, says the geologist, think that technology will save us. Well, your host interjects, "Not if Big Brother has anything to say about it, and even if it would, they're not going to let you have it." Says the author, and your host concurs, "Wind and solar won't save us either, because both would require a larger investment in materials and energy just to make them to begin with. They don't even produce that much over their entire useful lifespan than we have. So, given where we're at now, there's no way out, which means you're going to be paying much more to heat your homes. It also means you're going to be paying much more at the gas station, and far more still if you think an electric car is going to fix the problem. And you'll be paying a whole lot more for food, too. In fact, food prices have already started to go bananas, says Michael Snyder. Last week, Kraft Heinz announced they'll be soon raising prices on many of their most popular products by as much as 30% or so. So, yeah, no inflation there. And Kraft and Heinz aren't alone. P&G is going to raise prices on Tide and Gain laundry detergents, Downy fabric softener, and Bounce dryer sheets by an average of about 8% in the month of February. ConAgra, which makes brands like Slim Jim, Marie Callender's, and Bird's Eye, has said they plan to raise prices later in the year. And says Snyder, for a long time I've been specifically warning that food prices are about to go completely nuts, and now it's starting to happen right in front of our eyes. A new Gallup survey has just been released showing that a whopping 79% of all Americans expect even more inflation, and they're right on this one, in months ahead. Concludes Michael Snyder, the so-called experts at the unconstitutional Federal Reserve thought they could absolutely flood our financial system with funny money without any severe consequences. Similarly, politicians in the swamp thought they could borrow and spend trillions upon trillions of dollars without wrecking the fiat currency, and they were both wrong. Most of us have known it for a long time, but now even the hoi polloi is starting to realize, what are we going to do next? Says Snyder, the American people are going to be absolutely shocked by the level of economic pain that they're soon going to be forced to endure. Time draws short, folks, on just about every front, so batten down the hatches and get prepared while you still can.